March 17th, 2016, St. Paddy's Day. This is the Hermetic Hour with host Poke Runyon, and tonight we'll present a discussion and book reviews on magic in colonial America. Now, Frater Thavion, that's me, the old leprechaun, will deal with Howard Philip Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, a novel of necromantic alchemy set in colonial Providence, Rhode Island, and Lovecraft's occult source material will be my main focus. Our guest, Pater Fergoff, from the Valley Forge encampment in Pennsylvania, will discuss Daniel Harm's The Long-Lost Friend, a new translation of a Pennsylvania Dutch grimoire from the colonial period. So this should be a fun evening for you East Coast witches and warlocks. We did the fairies for the Irish folks last week. All right, are you with us there, Frater Fergoff?
Yes, sir, I am.
Ah, good, excellent. Let me get started here with Lovecraft's Charles Dexter Ward, and then we'll get right on over to the long lost friend. The Case of Charles Dexter Ward is one of Lovecraft's novels. He didn't write very many novels, actually. He's mostly a short story writer. And like all of his stories and his novels, it is set in New England, especially in areas where he grew up, and he works himself. As a child and teenager growing up into his stories, like Charles Dexter Ward especially. Now, the Case of Charles Dexter Ward is kind of a potpourri of everything that Lovecraft could dig up about what is generally considered to be black magic and just about everything he could. He tried to put just about everything that he could come up with that would make a good horror novel, something that like Dennis Wheatley did a few years later, and Stephen King, of course, took off with. And his idea here was a New England wizard and alchemist who, in Providence, Rhode Island, back in colonial times. Now, Lovecraft spent a lot of time growing up in Providence, Rhode Island, and he was very familiar with it. And so he decided to make this story involve heredity, family history, and a sort of a cross between heredity and reincarnation. And the basic plot of the story is Charles Dexter Ward has a great great grandfather, Joseph Curwood, who was the colonial period in Providence, Rhode Island, sinister alchemist and necromancer and wizard, he was actually burned to death by his neighbors for his hellish acts, and his spirit haunts the old house and haunts the old environment, and his spirit wants to return and take possession of his his protege, you know, of his descendant, young Charles Warren. So the spirit, this haunting goes on all during Ward's growing up, and the boy becomes an antiquarian. He's fascinated with his family history, and he's fascinated also with the history of Providence, Rhode Island, and all of the antiquities. And then gradually, what happens is that he grows up, and he's fascinated by all of this family history, and that the more he finds out about his great-grandfather, the more he gets interested in his great-grandfather's occult activities. And so gradually, what happens is you have a combination of we develop all of the first one-third of the book is his digging up all of the rumors and the information that he possibly can on his great grandfather's activities. And then as this continues, he discovers an old portrait of his great grandfather, and the portrait is a remarkable, it's a magical device in itself. And the portrait, he puts it up in his room, and the portrait, the eyes of the portrait follow him around the room. And the way Lovecraft develops this, it's a very haunting idea, the idea of the ancestor, who is pictured as a very evil person, taking over his descendant, and this starts at a very early point in the story. You can sort of see this succession process going on, both from a spiritual point of view, and also from the way it manifests in the young man's research and in his fascination. This story has been filmed twice, and the first version of it was back in the 60s. When some of you may remember Corman's Edgar Allan Poe films with Vincent Price did a couple of them, The Mask of Red Death and Brady. And they at that time Lovecraft hadn't achieved his new popularity, so they called The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, when they filmed it, they called it Edgar Allan Poe's Haunted Palace, and they used a poem by Poe, but the story was essentially The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, and Vincent Price played Charles Ward and his ancestor Joseph Kerwin, the screenplay of this film was by Charles Beaumont, and Charles Beaumont, of course, has written Lovecraftian stories and excellent writer and an excellent screenwriter. The screenplay, frankly, to tell you, the screenplay of The Haunted Palace is, I think, in many ways, a superior story-wise to the way Lovecraft actually did the novel. And I will say this: Vincent Price, in the film The Haunted Palace, Vincent Price is actually frightening. This is the only time in all the horror films he did, all of the rest of the horror films that Price did, he had his tongue in his cheek. He was. You could tell that he was having fun, and he really wasn't trying to scare anybody. But in this one, he really is frightening, and I highly recommend that. It's an old film, but it's very, very well done, and they change the story around a bit, but it's superior to the more recent version called The Resurrected, And the Resurrected is the same Charles Dexter Ward story, but it's updated into the 1990s, and they try to do it in contemporary. And it doesn't have the same production value as the Vincent Price film as the Haunted Palace. They had a high production value in the Haunted Palace, and very, very romantic and flavorful. So I would certainly recommend the Vincent Price version. Although August Derleth, Bob Crass publisher and editor and whatever, he didn't particularly like the Price version, but the important thing, you know, from our point of view, Hermetic point of view, is one Lovecraft story. Of all of the stories Lovecraft did, this was the one where Lovecraft really got into all of the Hermetic alchemical and magical literature, and from Agrippa, the Cave of Solomon, just everything everything that he could research, and had of course Charles Dexter Ward and Joseph Kerwin using these books, one of the reasons why I mention this is that this is within the context of magic and hermetic magic and alchemy and astrology and everything in the colonial period in the United States. And as you recall, we had a previous show called Weird Pennsylvania, where we discussed Pennsylvania Dutch family Quakers, who the Roman family, who had a copy of Agrippa, and they were into astrology and magic. And it's kind of similar to, so this sort of thing was going on, and it was going on here in colonial America. So Lovecraft's Chase of Charles Dexter Ward is very much goes along with that. Now, what was Joseph Kerwin and eventually his descendant, Charles Ward, what were they trying to do? They were actually into necromancy. And they were into necromancy and an alchemical version of it. And this is kind of strange because we don't usually connect alchemy and necromancy. The necromancy is the raising of the dead, and we think of a necromancer as going out in the graveyard in the middle of the night and digging up a corpse and having the corpse rise up and start talking to you and whatever. But in this case, in the case of Charles Dexter Ward, we're dealing with an alchemical version of it. And one of the things that I wanted to do for this show, discussing this, I wanted to try to see if I could dig into the sources that Lovecraft came up with on this necromantic alchemy. What were the sources? Now, right in the beginning of the novel, he has a quote, supposedly from an old alchemy book, and the quote reads, let me get to the page here, and the quote reads like this: "The essential salts of animals may be so prepared and preserved that an ingenious man may have the whole Ark of Noah in his own study and raise the fine shape of an animal out of its ashes at his pleasure, and by the like method, from the essential salts of human dust, a philosopher may, without any criminal necromancy, call up the shape of any dead ancestor from the dust whereunto his body has been incinerated, And this is signed Borellus, B-O-R-E-L-L-U-S. All right, that sounds sufficiently arcane and ancient. So, my first question, and yours would be too, who was Borellus? Well, I, in order to putting myself in Lovecraft's position, I thought, well, if I was Lovecraft and I wanted to find somebody like Borellus, where would I go? I'd go to Lim Thorndike's 8-volume set of History of Magic and Experimental Science, which would have been in the library for Lovecraft to get into. So I did, and I got into my own set of 8 volumes. And sure enough, Borellus turns out to be the pen name of a French alchemical writer by the name of Pierre Borel. But I couldn't find anything, you know, in Thorndike, anything like what like this. And so I thought, well, and that's probably not where Lovecraft went to find it. And so I kept wondering, you know, where did Lovecraft come up with this? And also, there is a number of rituals which were hauntingly familiar in the case of Charles Dexter Ward. There were a bunch of hermetic magic rituals that were very familiar, and so I got to thinking, well, you know, there's a lot of people that are really fascinated with Lovecraft and do a lot of research on this sort of thing, so maybe somebody has had the same question in their minds. Maybe somebody had the same question as mine. Where did Lovecraft get this? Where did it come from? And so I went to Google and I asked Google. You know, I said, okay, where did Lovecraft get his sources on necromantic alchemy? And sure enough, somebody had done the work, and I found it. And I found it in, I think Google's putting the library out of business in some ways. And I found the whole 9 yards on this, and 21-page paper by, and I get the fellow's name so I could give him credit for it here, let's see. This 21-page paper on all of Lovecraft's sources for Charles Dexter Ward, all his occult sources, is by Joseph Morales. It's copyright 2006 by Joseph Morales. And he has his email or website on here. So you can go and you can check this out. And just look for sources of necromancy in Charles Dexter Ward. And so what he, not only does he cite the source for this essential salts thing, which turns out to be Cotton Mather. Now, if in case you don't know who Cotton Mather is, well, Cotton Mather was the firebrand preacher who stirred up the witchcraft mania around the Salem witchcraft trials back to 1699. Cotton Mather was a Boston the Boston preacher who was one of these people who was fascinated by the occult and fascinated by black magic and witchcraft and read everything he could possibly get his hands on the subject. But at the same time, he ranted and raved about how evil it was. And according to what Joseph Morales says in his article here, is that Cotton Mather actually rewrote Borellus and made it seem a little more arch than it actually was. So it's possible it's as much Mather that quote about the essential salts can be attributed just as much to Mather as it can be to Pierre Borel. In any way, he also found out, by the way, that is not that Morales quote comes from, doesn't come from the Wonders of the Invisible World, which is the most noted of Mather's books, the one that that deals with all the witchcraft. It comes from another book of his, which has a Christian title. So Morales did a lot of research on this, and I discovered, interestingly enough, based on this, I discovered that the same process, the same business of taking the ashes or the essential salts of an animal or a person, also shows up in a grimoire that MacGregor Mathers found in the arsenal in Paris, which has been published. It's called The Grimoire of Armadale. And it's translated by MacGregor Mathers, whom we are all familiar with. And in here, they have this whole operation laid out, but they give, well, the good thing about the Grimoire of Armadale is it goes back even further, and it gives us the original source for this whole idea of being able to resurrect the dead, or at least the shades of the dead, from their essential salts or their ashes or whatever. And what's the source on all this? The original source? The Bible. Oh, yeah. Yes, the Bible. And the book of Ezekiel. And, of course, we remember the Valley of the Dry Bones in Ezekiel. And I was saying that we could have if you want to have a little diversity in here, we could have the hoodoo version of this, you know, if coming from the book of Ezekiel, you know, them bones, them dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. So we can have a hoodoo down home hoodoo version of this too. And a lot of the rituals that Lovecraft used, he took directly from, according to what Joe Morales found out, he took these directly from Arthur Edward Waite's The Mysteries of Magic, which was a compendium of the works of Eliphas Levy. And he just, you know, picked them directly out of there and used them, which is fine. Dennis Wheatley was doing the same thing, and he also cribbed from Dracula. He had Charles Ward going over to Transylvania and spending some time with a Transylvanian baron, very much like Dracula, and comes back, and then there's chases of vampirism all over New Providence, Rhode Island, of course, according to story. So he gets the vampire thing into this too, and works all of this in, and then, of course, eventually Joseph Kerwin completely returns, takes over completely, and replaces his great-grandson, Charles Dexter Ward's gone, and Kerwin has returned. And, of course, the resurrected Kerwin ends up in a mental institution, and so ends the story, at least in that respect. Now, the only other little note I want to make on this thing before we close the book on Charles Dexter Ward is that if you would like to set up a Charles Dexter Ward Alchemical Laboratory, or at least something that looks like one, the Howard Philip Lovecraft Society, the some of those same people who did that wonderful Call of Cthulhu movie, they have a big urn of essential salts that they will sell you for $55. And it has a wax hermetic seal on the top of it. And they tell you, don't open this and don't open it. Don't burn it. Don't do anything with it. And for heaven's sake, don't eat it. And it's just strictly for it's strictly a prop. But, and it goes along with a parchment, copy of a letter from the case of Charles Dexter Ward authenticating it. So if you want to have it and set it up on your shelf to amuse your friends, you can find that also. Just go to HPLS and their shop and also if you haven't seen their film The Whisperer in the Darkness, you give it a look. That's one of the best Lovecraft films ever made, and those the old Call of Cthulhu is very good too. But this is Charles Dexter Ward, as I said, is an American horror story that has had a lot of influence on Stephen King, obviously, and it's one of Lovecraft's most entertaining of his novels. Josh, do you want to tell us about the long lost friend?
Oh sure. Hey, I also have Robert Shriver on the line, who's an actual brookery and hexery practitioner. So not only will we have the book tonight, but we've got someone who actually is familiar with the workings and an authoritative source on the modern practice of the thing.
Well, great.
But,
want to say hello?
Hey, you hear me?
Well, hi there. Yeah, I'm Poker Onion, tell us who you are again and a little bit about yourself.
My name is Robert Shriver. I am a practitioner of Brauchery and Hexerei in the Orglova context. Orglova is the pursuit of the heathen religion through the lens of the Pennsylvania Dutch or Pennsylvania German culture.
Yeah, well, sounds like you're just the guy we need to talk about this. We already know that the 6th and 7th books of Moses were quite popular in the Pennsylvania Dutch area, and you want to give us an idea of what essentially we'd like to know about Harm's version of a long lost friend and what's in it and tell us about Josh, if Josh will, and then give us a practitioner's view, okay?
I have to be upfront though. I am by practice in the Orglova context, not the Christian context. Therefore, I really don't use Homan's long lost friend that much anymore. I used it when I was first in training, but there's a lot more to the practices of Brauchery and Hexerei that are contained within that book. And that's the part that Josh kind of wanted me to focus on a little bit.
Well, then tell us what you recommend for people that want to get something that's more authentic than do you have something else you would recommend instead of the long lost friend?
Yeah, it's not about like authenticity is a rough word because there's more than one religious tradition going on here. Homan is certainly very widespread, and less so now I would say than maybe 100 years ago when it was pretty much the publication for the long lost friend. But it's not the earliest one here in the colonies. my friend and colleague Patrick Donmoyer put out another grimoire that preceded Homon, and that was called Der Freund in der Nord. I'm going to be saying with Pennsylvania Dutch pronunciation, Der Freund in der Nord, or Der Freund in der Nord. And that's another one that people might want to look into. It's fairly heavily Christian-based also, but it provides other insights and reveals that there was variation in practice all across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania back as early as the colonial era.
Well, now I don't know. I am very, very meagerly informed on powwow. I had my mother grew up in the in the Pennsylvania area, and so I've been up there several times. And I've seen the hex signs on the, on the old farmhouses and what have you. I understand, as I originally mentioned the sixth and seventh books of Moses, which I know were quite popular in that area. Let me ask you, one of the things about German magic that I've been aware of since graduate school, because I tried to study the whole course of Hermetic magic in Europe. The Faustian school seems to be pretty much of a German development. And there's a whole series of grimoires, that might be termed Faustian, like the fourfold harrowing of hell and various things like this. How much of this Faustian, these Faustian grimoires do you think were actually involved in the Pennsylvania Dutch practice? Did the Faustian school figure in any of this?
I admit that I'm familiar with Faust, but I'm not quite as familiar with the segregation of the term across a series of books or anything. But I can tell you the ones that I knew from the time I was growing up that were considered part of Braucherei for many of the Christian practitioners around me. They were Albertus Magnus, the sixth and seventh books of Moses, and then either Homon or that's the long lost friend, or the friend of the friend of the note, or other books, or many of them just did their own charms, or each individual guild had its own set of charms that were shared amongst its members. That's a very common thing. So essentially there are organic little unwritten books that are passed from practitioner to practitioner within various guilds, and that's sort of how we're doing it currently within our guilds, although we are trying to get the stuff written down that can be written down. There's a lot that can't be written down, which is always a complicating factor for those of us whose memories are fading. But I have all those books in my possession, some in English, some in German. Again, I don't use them so much because the context of Christianity is not as applicable to me, but there are things that we have drawn from them, particularly as relating to house blessings. And in a sense, we had to re-heathenize some things. The sixth and seventh books of Moses, when I was a kid, most of my plain relatives, the sectarian folks, looked upon those as books that needed to be bound up. They were not, they were supposed to be ones that were dangerous to read. If you read them and you were not trained properly, you could easily bind yourself or read yourself fast and end up being possessed by the devil or evil spirits, etc. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not, but there's some story there.
This aspect sort of hangs over all of these magic books that I know that when we were discussing the Roman family, the very fact that they had these books, the very fact that they had a copy of Agrippa, you know, of the three books of occult philosophy of Agrippa, was enough to raise suspicion that they were doing evil, you know, they were engaged in evil practices. And I, you know, that's very, very hard to justify with Agrippa, but then on the other hand, that seems to be the when people get in this, you know, this mode of being like inquisitors, then they think anything, the biblical view, although there's all kinds of astrology in the Bible, all through the Bible, it, yet at the same time there are numerous verses in the Bible that condemn astrology, and even say that people who practice it should be exterminated or whatever, and yet it's so. We have that problem. And that suspicion. That one of the things that the suspicion of evil involved in occult practice is one of the motifs that Lovecraft used all through the case of Charles Dexter Ward. He was continually using the opinions of the neighbors and the opinions of the townspeople as a means of raising the fear, you know, of Kerwin and Ward and what they were doing. It was part of the whole fear thing. In fact, as I read it, I began to think that this was almost like this satanic ritual abuse furor that we had here in this country back in the 90s. It seems like just every so often the extreme religious strains of fundamentalism, they rise up and see anything occult as being evil. Do you think that's still the case with your practice?
It depends on where you are. It really does depend. It depends on where you are, because originally, for the most part, within most areas of Pennsylvania, Brauchari especially, was just part of the folk religion. They were the village doctors, and there was not the stigma attached to it so much. It was when fundamentalists from other areas came in, because for the most part, the Lutherans and the Reformed just accepted it as part of the culture. It just existed. Hexerei was a different matter, but I'll get to that in a second. But it was when some of the Baptist churches began to increase in population in this part of the country. At least that's the lore that our Brauchari Guild told us, that once the Southern Baptist churches started moving into our areas, that then they started seeing our people doing these things and started calling it satanic. And then Hexerei, however, has had a stigma attached to it much longer than that, partially because it had an older connection and maintained a little bit more of a conscious focus on the, quote, helpful entities, end quote, that we would know as old Germanic deities. And so they had a little bit more of a stigma. Part of the problem is, though, that depending on where you are in Pennsylvania, Brauchari and Hexerei either considered two separate practices, or in some places they use both terms to mean the same thing. Other places they use one term to mean both things. So the way that people treat it is also dependent on the construct of their variant of the Dyke's language. But the stigma doesn't continue quite as much, but you know, as recently as I would say 2008, there was a little bit of a hysteria about people volunteering somewhere because they were, quote, witches, end quote, for practicing Brauchari. So it still happens. I think it's going to be a while before that sort of thing goes away.
Yeah, as long as we have what we refer to as fundamental religious movements activities, we're going to have this, you know, we're definitely going to have this, because one of the things that we know that fundamental religious families want to control their children's thinking, and one of the ways they control their children's thinking is to forbid them any knowledge of anything that they consider to be weird or strange or occult or whatever, and then they take that and they try to impose that on the rest of society, and we get that attitude. There's a lot of in the sixth and seventh books of Moses, there is quite a bit of Kabbalah, as Joe Peterson has pointed out, and some of it is Kabbalah in that is actually pretty good. I mean, it's actually rather authentic and are you familiar with the Kabbalistic aspects of that book?
I've read through that book when I was younger, but since my Brockeri training began, I'm not the Judeo-Christian context at all. I'm familiar with the presence of it being there, but I've never studied it in detail.
This is kind of a place that I can jump in here. I've been absolutely enjoying the dialogue, though. I was raised. What you said earlier resonates with me. My grandfather was a Freemason, and we thought that maybe he was involved in other stuff, and kind of knew that we were involved in Pennsylvania Dutch stuff, but it was really lost because my father himself said, okay, we're going to be regular old good Presbyterians. We're not going to go stick our hands in things. So, you know, the easiest way to get kids interested into something is to tell them don't be interested in it, right? So I tell my kids not to look at the space shuttle and don't do math. So, the whole reason why I came across The Long Lost Friend is it was the forbidden grimoire, right? And so for me, coming from a Christian context with a little bit of esotericism, I pick up this book and, oh man, this is evil stuff, right? And I tie a bat to my arm and I win at cards, right? And, you know, nowadays it seems sort of hokey, but, you know, actually nowadays you go to the Valley Forge Casino and they charge a cover for the bat and then throw you out and tell you that the bat was card counting, but the whole thing, it's really neat because it has Christian elements to it and it has these pagan elements to it, and I think that that's what's sort of interesting is the duality in the system is the Christian elements are psalmistry, sort of along the lines of the Liturgy of Solomon or John Dee reciting the penitential psalms before he operated his magic. And then there's practical portions of it, such as how to staunch the flow of blood. And it's very practical stuff. And it's almost written, you know, today we would look at it in our sea of available information and say, well, this is kind of a pulp recipe book, you know, my first 1,001 spell book kind of an idea. But back then it was the opposite. It was precious in that the people who were educated wanted to take notes, but they didn't really want to give away the whole thing, right? So that's really where we get into Harm's work here with The Long Lost Friend is the reason why Harm's book is valuable is because the thing it's extremely well cited. It's fantastic from an academic perspective, but he's combined the various volumes together and then offered the whole thing up in German in the appendix. And that by itself is a gold mine of resources to learn and read, but he also very nicely delineates, you know, it's done with spacing and maybe it's part of the original book. I'm not familiar enough with the original, and I certainly can't read enough German to decide, but it delineates between the pagan portions of it and the Christian portions of it. Like, what prayer do I say to aid in hysterics? And, oh, by the way, I can kill a dove and drink its blood, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So that by itself is fantastic, but that's the Pennsylvania Dutch tradition here, is very much Christian elements and pagan elements, and the two sides don't always get along. And that's also really why I invited Rob on the program, because, you know, my Christian upbringing looks at everything one way. He's got a very pagan take on it. He looks at it the other way. Pope, you've got an anthropological take on it. You look at it the third way. You know, it's a fantastic discussion.
You know, there was a Christian community in Pennsylvania in colonial times, and in fact, one of our members discovered that they even had in their documentation, they even had their own reproduction of Johann Gichtel's Universal Man, which is one of the sources for the Western chakra system. And the Rosicrucian traditions, although so definitely the Rosicrucian tradition was in Pennsylvania and had some influence, you know, obviously on some of this. I'm not saying that it necessarily influenced, it didn't influence the sixth and seventh books, but Moses, but it was there, and yet at the same time, Rosicrucian, just because somebody's is a Rosicrucian or says he is, that doesn't remove him from being suspected of practicing dire occultism or whatever. Are you both familiar with that Rosicrucian community?
Yes, it's the you can still visit the cave. You can still visit Kelpius Cave down there on Hermit Lane down in Philly. It's pretty remarkable because essentially it was a doomsday cult. I actually first learned about it accidentally through a dream, but it's, you know, it's right there. The Rosicrucians have a marker by it if you go to visit it. It's kind of hard to find in the woods, but it's pretty cool that it's a remnant of this migration of German Rosicrucians into Pennsylvania back in, you know, in the early in the Pennsylvania German migration. So it's pretty cool.
We're going to have a field trip to that. I think that'll be really cool for the locals.
Have you ever been down there?
No, I haven't. I've heard a lot about it. I've been to the Rosicrucian church in, I guess it's Quakertown, with the pyramid and the lovely gardens and all the rest of it, and the very loud dogs.
you were mentioning sometime back a contemporary Rosicrucian presence there, and I was getting that confused with the colonial one, because I don't think the colonial one has any it doesn't have any present connection to the one that's there now, does it?
Not that I know of. All I know is that the Rosicrucians do have a contemporary marker there, but I don't know that it's the same. Like, I don't know if they have the same origins from one Rosicrucian community to another. It could just be that, you know, the contemporaries went there to honor it and put something up. But Josh, I think that we ought to do a little trip down to there and hit Germantown while we're there.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good research project to try to get to find out what the old colonial people were doing and all. And as I said, we our friend Hermes, who is quite a researcher, he discovered that they actually had this Gichtel's University, his Universal Man, that the little drawing that shows the psychic centers, and it would be interesting to locate the historical aspect of that. I'd like to do a show on that if you guys could come up with enough background on it. That'd be a good one. Josh, are you can you go along with what your friend is his opinion on the the long lost friend, or do you think we ought to look at something else instead, or do you think that the long lost friend has some merit in this area?
The long lost friend I almost love it because it's a bit of a lie, right? So the practice, the actual practice of Valkyrie and how it exists in modern form doesn't have a lot to do with the long-lost friend. And the Pennsylvania Dutch community has evolved past the use of that book if it was ever a centerpiece of the community. I certainly remember my grandfather was definitely a psalmist and some version of esoteric Christianity. But, you know, the community itself, especially when you look at things like the hex signs, I know it was one of Fred Roden's topics you wanted us to talk about. You know, they have teacups on them and they have pineapples and stuff like that. And the community has modernized itself. It just hasn't stayed in this single thing. But the message, the bones have always been the same. It's not hex signs as in I'm casting a terrible curse upon somebody, but rather, how do I ward off evil? How do I help people? And, you know, that's sort of an appealing message, no matter whether you're on the Christian or pagan side of the fence, even the Masons, right? It's how do I help people within my capacity to do so? And any way that people approach that topic is, I think, a good thing. You know, Christian, Mason, Rosicrucian, you know, anything to that effect. That message has always been there in the faith. And, you know, that's what I think I like about it. The other fun thing is, you know, the Rosicrucian thing, especially if you really have a more esoteric bent, is all of the books claim that they're Egyptian, right? Or that they're the lost tribe in Africa, or that they're, you know, something along those lines. So the romanticism is there too, where we believe that, you know, it was delivered by, you know, the muffled voices of mummies or, you know, angels from heaven or something like that. So it's fun. It hasn't really pigeonholed itself into one thing. It's kind of gotten all over the place. That's one of the things Rob was alluding to earlier is, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted Kevin on the show, but he turned into a pumpkin, was the language is very slightly different among all of the various enclaves of Pennsylvania Dutch practice, and the practices are different among the Pennsylvania Dutch practice. So, you know, the Long Lost Friend is certainly one of the centerpiece works, but it by no means comprehensive or even authoritative as to what the modern state of it is. All of these guys, all of these little communities have their own practice, and that's absolutely fascinating. You know, we have what's written down, but it really makes you wonder what's not written down. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's also been said that Homan was a marketing genius. He was, and so you're looking, his product is the marketing genius version, rather than necessarily the one that the average person would have used before him. And you know, once it came out, then things were readily available, so of people bought it, and it is. I mean, it's a very useful book for people who view things through the lens of the Christian context, you know, so I would certainly consider it, but I would try to consider the entirety of the practice and rather than looking at Homan as being the whole practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, you don't think it's a good introduction to all of this. What would you agree on would be a good introduction or a good summary of the magic and practice and witchcraft and everything in Pennsylvania? Is there one book? Is there one book that you'd recommend that would cover the whole? It would cover the whole spectrum.
Well,
I couldn't even begin to speculate.
Let me put it this way: there.
And if not, why don't you guys collaborate and write one?
Well, eventually, you know, because we actually have very active within the Org Walva community, which again is from the heathen denomination that is, you know, that is with viewing heathenry through the lens of the Pennsylvania Dutch culture. We are very actively philosophizing, scrutinizing our folklore, our superstitions, everything, and but we haven't gotten around yet to writing a book per se. That's something that's on my plate that I haven't quite accomplished yet. There are books out there, and I won't say them by name, simply because the way that they came about, I'm not particularly comfortable with. But there are books out there that give pretty much away the entire Braukerei practice, perhaps beyond the point that that some of us are comfortable with due to the nature of the things that are not supposed to be written. But there are books out there, but they're pretty much focused totally on the Christian context. Eventually more stuff will be coming out from the viewpoint of the heathen side of the practice. But that's going to be a little while in the development. But in the meantime, on Facebook and on the internet, we do have our websites and we do have some information that's out there. And if I say it, I don't know if anybody will know it, but I can probably get links to Josh and you, and you guys can put them up if people find that to be of interest.
Right. Okay. Give us a website reference then that you would suggest that people that are interested in this, in what we've been discussing, and would like to follow it up. Is there a website that you'd like them to go to?
Yeah, there's actually, I'll give you the one that you can use to jump to the others, and that's braucherei.org, and that's braucherei.org. And along the right-hand side when you get in there, there's a listing of a whole bunch of previous newsletters called Hall of Bear Haven. That newsletter comes from the Braukerei Guild and then eventually comes from the Orgwalva community. And all those are free PDF downloads that people can can download and read at their convenience. From there you can jump onto some of the other websites, which include our herbalism and practices such as that. And if I don't have them up, I will put up in the next day or two links to our Facebook groups and stuff as well.
What we needed to know.
The opposite end of that, I'd really like to plug the Dr. Kevin Sterner, who's been absolutely fantastic, just to have him ramble at me in the original language, none of which I understand, and the Pennsylvania German Society, who's really been doing well to keep the history alive. Through the practice of recitals and competitions like spelling bees and just like, sort of simple community efforts, the Pennsylvania Dutch community is slowly getting preserved. And one of the neat things is that the Buffington Barba Orthography, which is really how Pennsylvania Dutch gets written down, is getting improved and sort of modernized, and more books, just historical books of what little is written down, are coming to light through the Pennsylvania German Society and other academic organizations. And Simon's actually the guy who hooked me up with Rod, and it's been, even in the short time that I've talked to him, it's just been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I will say that I've been very much involved in the renaissance of the Pennsylvania German language since the 1980s. I actually taught at Kutztown University for 4 semesters. It is important, but for me, it's not about preservation, it's about advancement. And it's a minor detail, but preservation doesn't go anywhere, advancement does. And so we have a long road ahead of us before I die, but we got our community is growing, not just here in Pennsylvania, but it's growing out in the in other areas where the Pennsylvania Germans settled. And even to folks who are not of Pennsylvania German descent, which is more than welcome. And I'm very happy and very proud to see that people are finding our ancestors' knowledge to be worthy of pursuit even into today. So,
well, we're glad to give you any help we possibly can in outreach wise, and we really appreciate you coming on the show, and we're just about out of time, and so I want to thank you both, and Josh, is there anything you'd like to say in relation to you and Valley Forge before we sign off?
I think tonight's been a fantastic program. We're enjoying the OTA stuff here. Our guys are also interested in local history, so this was, fantastic, and it's a neat opportunity to talk about it on the national level.
Well,
yeah, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, it was our pleasure, and keep up the good work. And next week, I don't know quite what we'll have on tap, but we'll try to have another interesting show with another interesting guest. And until then, good magic, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
All right, thank you.
Take care.